So my guest today is Sven Nyholm. Sven is an assistant professor of philosophy and ethics at the Eindhoven University of Technology. He's a graduate of the University of Michigan, receiving his doctorate there in 2012. His dissertation dealt with Kantian moral philosophy and was published in book form by De Gruyter in 2015. Before joining the faculty at Eindhoven, he was a Wissenschaftlicher Mitarbeiter at the University of Cologne in Germany from 2012 to 2015. So I think I first met Sven a couple of years ago at a neuroethics workshop in Paris, and I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, we spent some time talking about our appreciation for philosophy podcasts and their value. So I'm hoping that we can live up to our own expectations of the genre in today's conversation. Anyway, I'd like to welcome you to the show, Sven.
Well, thank you, John. Thanks for inviting me to participate.
Great. I invited you to participate primarily because you're currently doing a lot of work on the ethics of biomedical technologies, in particular looking at technologies aimed at enhancing or improving human experience and behavior. So our conversation today will focus on three broad themes that all connect with or intersect with the focus of this Algocracy and Transhumanism project that I'm running. In particular, we'll focus on the medicalization of value, the nature and value of the self and how it can be affected by technology, and also the design of ethical algorithms. So let's start into the first of those topics, which is how technology might change the way in which we value things. So one of the big themes within my project is the way in which new technologies alter old values and or create new values or just change the way in which we value things. And one of the central human values is love and the experience of romantic love. Now, Brian Earp, Anders Sandberg, and Julian Savulescu, all based out of Oxford, have written a series of papers arguing in favor of the biomedical enhancement of love. Now, you've been slightly skeptical of their project, and you think that it can affect or alter the way in which we value things. And I think what you say in relation to this topic has more general implications for how technology affects values. So let's focus initially on the particular debate about love and then broaden it out. So let me just ask a simple question to start out with. What is love enhancement and is it possible?
Yeah, so maybe to answer that, first to say something about how Earp, Savulescu, and Sandberg understand love. And then we'll just give an example of the animal kingdom before moving to the human case. So first of all, theories of love kind of divide into those that are more biological and naturalistic, if you will, on the one hand, and theories that are more cultural or that emphasize the social construction of love on the other. Savulescu and company are leaning towards the first, more biological side. They're very much inspired by an anthropologist called Helen Fisher, who argues that love is actually based on human evolution and who divides love into three different stages. The first being lust. You are experiencing a general attraction to let's focus on the heterosexual
sexual desire for somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, that's doesn't necessarily yet have an object, but then you may find someone to whom you are attracted, and attraction then is the second stage, and then the final stage, if things work out well, is attachment. All of these three stages are associated with specific neurochemicals and specific hormones. It turns out that maybe if we're taking other kind of medications or if things just happen in a normal way, these hormones and chemicals, they alter and change. And depending on what state, how things are working out, love may or may not come about. Now, let's then go to this other example before we get to love enhancement. There's some interesting research on these cute little rodents called prairie voles, who are, they're not only cute, but they're also very monogamous. They find a partner and they have very strong pair bonding. They also have a cousin, the meadow voles, they look exactly the same, but they don't have this kind of pair bonding. Some scientists found that if you transfer some genetic materials from the monogamous voles to the non-monogamous ones, you can actually alter their sort of pair bonding patterns and so make the non-monogamous vole more monogamous. And also in the prairie vole, that's the monogamous one, if you block certain neurochemicals, you make them stop pair bonding in a strong sort of way. The idea from writers like Savulescu, Earp, and Sandberg is that, if you can do this in animals, and if certain, say, antidepressants and drugs like that have effects on human hormones and neurochemicals, it should be possible to develop drugs. Sometimes they talk about this as love drugs that we could use to control these three stages of love, lust, attraction, and attachment to a much greater degree than we can normally do. And that would be what they mean by love enhancements. Why would you want to do that? Well, they say that, you know, love is one of the best things in life, has lots of wonderful effects. People are healthier, they're happier, they get more sex and all sorts of things that they want. Maybe you are under a duty to love certain people. So there are really many things that you can maybe achieve by bringing these neurochemicals under greater control. And that's what's meant by love enhancements.
Yeah, so maybe I'll just come back in here. Yep. And note that they have also written about ways in which similar technologies could be used to disrupt problematic relationships or problematic attachment to other human beings.
Yeah, it's those are they call them the anti-love drugs. And so suppose that you're in a very abusive relationship, but somehow you're still very attached to your partner and just can't make yourself leave the relationship. Then, well, maybe what you need is an anti-love drug rather than a love drug, a love enhancement drug. So, yeah, that's certainly also something that they discuss. But maybe we should focus on the positive case of drugs to bring about and then sustain love.
Yeah, absolutely. And just in terms of, is there any evidence that there are currently available drugs or treatments that have these positive effects on attachment in human beings? So we have the Vole example, which has mm-hmm. been discussed widely, but is there anything in human beings that can have a similar effect?
Well, what Savulescu and company discuss mainly is a kind of nasal spray when you spray oxytocin into people's noses. And that seems to at least affect the degree to which people trust each other and are willing to rely on each other. I don't know if there have been any love drugs that have been developed that are clinically proven to work very well, but that's the sort of the case that they talk about a lot.
Yeah, so I mean, at the moment it is...
Yeah, it's a very not at a very advanced stage. And so a lot of their discussion is like, you know, maybe if this is possible to do in animals, we should try to also develop it in human beings. And the question then is that a good idea? Should we? And actually, in one of the early papers, Sandberg and Savulescu say that, yes, it's not just a good idea, but it's an obligation to do this because love is such an important part of human life.
Their argument in favor of love enhancement is relatively easy to understand, basically in the sense that love is such an important and central human value. And if we can do anything to improve it, improve the availability of it and the strength of the experience for people, that would be a good thing. Now, I'm aware that there are a lot of objections to this in the literature, so perhaps you could just review a few of those standard objections to love enhancement before focusing on maybe one in particular.
So we will get to the so-called medicalization objection, but let's set that aside for now. I guess a lot of the main objections are different kind of skeptical objections, meaning that people, I mean myself included, I've written on this, are skeptical as to whether this would really be love that you would create if you have to use the so-called love drugs in order to have two people be attached to each other. There are many ideas and associations that we have with respect to love that, they come from a long tradition of literature, philosophy, and just general sort of everyday thinking about love. And it's not clear that all of these are kind of favorable to the idea of love enhancements. And so let me just quickly mention a few things that you may think might clash with this idea of using love drugs. Well, there's an old idea that I guess goes back to Plato of, you know, the idea of finding one's other half, a person with whom you're a very good match, but just because you are the person that you are and that he or she is the person that he or she is. And it seems that if that can happen between two people and you actually need to use hormone treatments, these love drugs that stimulate your neurochemicals in order to bring about a relationship between two people. Well, that's certainly one association that people have to love that maybe doesn't seem to be quite fulfilled if you need to use love enhancements, this idea of finding that person who's your other half that was kind of made for you, as people sometimes say. Another idea discussed, for example, by the philosopher Niko Kolodny, or Kolodny, I'm not sure exactly how to say it, is this idea that love should grow over time on the basis of the shared history that the two lovers have together. That, as they get to know each other better, they find that, well, it's even more true than they thought initially, that they are kind of a good match and that they really want to build this thing together. If you find, however, over time that actually you would need to use love enhancements in order to sustain an attachment, Well, that seems to be another thing that suggests that this is not really a case of love. You might be able to have an attachment between these two people using the love enhancements, but perhaps that would not quite fit with our idea of love. It would be some other kind of good, but maybe not one as attractive as love.
Yeah, and I guess that actually raises something important, which links to the objection we'll talk about, which is, I mean, the way in which the use of the love enhancement technology alters or changes what we value. So we're not really valuing what we think we were valuing in the first place. But yeah, let's talk about this medicalization objection, because this is something that you've written about in particular. So what is this medicalization objection to love enhancement?
Well, I mean, it comes from a more general worry about more and more domains of human life being treated as if they're medical issues. And that's sometimes called the medicalization worry. Think about, for example, school children who are not quite behaving well in class. They're sent maybe not to the principal's office, but to the school nurse and given, the proper drugs to, and they're said to have medical problems. And so some people think that's very good, but some people worry about this and say that that's a way of medicalizing what's really just a matter of kids being kids and so on. But, or just take another example before we get to love. This is not my own view, but some people think that if you treat something like drug addiction or alcohol addiction as a medical issue rather than as a matter of not being able to exercise willpower, then you are medicalizing something for which you should really be personally responsible. I mean, that's not my view. I think that's not true, but that's just another case where people disagree about whether it's proper to treat something as a medical issue. Now, in the case of love, some people worry that if we start prescribing love drugs as a way of promoting people's relationship health, and you think that the proper solution to love problems is to go to the doctor and get some love medication, then you're treating this as a medical issue rather than as a social issue or
an interpersonal issue.
Indeed. And actually, then the question, of course, becomes, what exactly is problematic about that? What's wrong about that? And then a lot of the discussion about this, my own papers on this and also people like Savulescu and Earp and company, is, okay, well, how can we make this objection more specific? And then the question is it a good objection?
Yeah, sure. So let's dive into this issue in a bit more detail, because in one of your papers you outlined there are different ways of understanding the medicalization objection. In particular, you can understand it as an instrumental or intrinsic objection to love enhancement in particular. So maybe you could explain the difference between those ways of understanding the medicalization objection.
Yes, and so actually in an important paper on this by Earp and company, they say, well, really the worry here is that it might have really bad effects to treat love as a medical issue. And they discuss a number of such possible bad effects, giving medical drug companies too much power over people's lives. If they can convince people that they have a medical problem, they can sell more drugs. And so there's a worry about being taken advantage of from drug industry, giving doctors too much power over our personal lives, treating something as a biological issue that's really a social matter, that could be seen as bad because then we don't focus on the real problems that people might have in their relationships. And so these are a bunch of worries about the possible bad effects of treating love as a medical issue. Now, that's the sort of the instrumental understanding of the medicalization objection. And I think those are some important worries, and Savulescu, Earp, and Sandberg also take those worries very seriously, but they argue that on the whole, the good effects of love drugs would outweigh the bad possible effects. Now, I think that maybe there's also a different worry that people that have this kind of medicalization worry might be having, and that is of a more intrinsic kind. And to try to spell that out, what I did in my paper on this was to define what I called not just a category mistake in general, but what I called an evaluative category mistake. So one of the ways in which people define what medicalization is that you take something that is not necessarily regarded as a medical issue normally, and then you turn it into a medical issue. Now that may be seen as a kind of category mistake. That is to say, mistakenly treating something that really is not in one category as if it's in that category. And specifically, it could be seen as treating a certain kind of value, namely the value of love, as if it's in a different category of value. And so I specify that in two ways in my paper. First, if you think only about the effects of using love drugs, either positive effects or negative effects, on the positive side, you might have things such as people are actually healthier when they have lover relationships, they're happier. On the negative side, you might have things such as, well, maybe we're giving over too much control to the drug industry and so on. Then you seem to be treating love as if it's mainly of an instrumental sort of value, whereas it seems that love is actually one of the things that, if you look at different lists that people sometimes try to compile of what are the intrinsic most important ends of life, typically you would find love on some of these lists. Certainly, if you look at recent lists that people have tried to, you know, in the philosophical literature on so-called objective list theories of the good, and you know, what are the kinds of goods that people say are objective goods that you need to have a good life, and love would be one important example of such an intrinsic good. Now, so that's on the one hand, one way of in which this might be seen as a kind of evaluative category mistake. The other way is that actually Earp, Sandberg, and Savulescu, they do say, well, maybe you could actually consider love to be a kind of value in itself and not just as an instrument in their paper. But then when they go on to describe what that could mean, they seem to say things such as, well, you know, when we take a scientific point of view on something, it can become more fascinating. Like, for example, if you look at a, I don't know, an insect or a flower in a microscope, you can see all these small details that you couldn't otherwise see. And that could give you a whole new perspective, and it could become fascinating in a new sort of way. And similarly, if you think about the evolutionary history of love and the neurochemicals involved, you might think that that's really fascinating. You might get a new kind of appreciation of love as something that's really interesting and fascinating in its own right. Now, I agree with all of that, and the way they talk about it, it's very contagious, and you kind of get into the, you can really understand the mindset of someone who approaches love with a microscope and a scientific eye. However, that doesn't seem to fit with the way that people normally and typically value love. It's not something that people typically value as a kind of an object of scientific study or theoretical reflection. It's typically valued as a more practical goal, something that you strive for, something that you want in your life, something that you care for emotionally from the point of view of what sort of things you want to engage in and actively pursue, and not as something that you study in a scientific sort of way.
I mean, there's a lot in what you just said, but I appreciate this idea that there's a narrow conception of well-being perhaps motivating the argument in Earp and Savulescu and Sandberg's work, because the good of love is reduced to a good of well-being in the sense of health and hedonic satisfaction, whereas in the majority of contemporary objective list type utilitarian or moral theories, love is singled out as an independent good, which I guess in some sense is incommensurate with and irreducible to other kinds of goods. It's something unique that stands on its own.
Yes, if you think of what is it to lead a full human life, what are the different aspects? Since we are fairly complex beings, a lot of people think that, you know, a good human life, it's really something that has many different components and aspects. So you might, on the one hand, want to have friends, you might want to have some interesting occupation of some sort, you may want to have art and knowledge in your life, but also having love seems to be one of the things that, if you want to think about, you know, what would be a really full and rich human life, that would be sort of an independent component that doesn't just reduce to some combination of the others. It's not just a matter of pleasure, it's not just a matter of, art. I mean, there's a lot of art to do with love, and you know, most love songs, most pop songs are love songs, and movies are about love and so on. But it does seem to be something that people really care about for its own sake, and that they think that to have a complete life, love seems to be something that you want to have.
Yeah, and it's also not then a purely intellectual matter. It's not a matter of understanding exactly the mechanics of love, how it works, and knowing where to intervene in the mechanism. Love is a more kind of practical and lived experience. It's something valued through the practice and the emotional connection, and not just through the intellectual reflection on love. Although presumably you can have both. And I guess the fear is that...
Yep.
enhancement or the medicalization of love, let's say, for the time being, changes the way in which we conceive of love and prioritizes that intellectual reflection over the practical lived experience of love.
Indeed. And I mean, and you can also imagine that this is something I do in one of my papers on this, that like if you imagine different scenarios where you... Well, let's do this contrast. So suppose that you think that actually your partner has been using love enhancements to be able to stay attached to you, but then it turns out that that was not the case. You would probably feel that that's really good news. Whereas if you, in contrast, thought that, well, you had just a normal, well-functioning love relationship, but then you find out that your partner thinks that, well, it's good for their health to be in a love relationship, and he or she doesn't particularly feel that he or she can sustain that kind of relationship to you without using love enhancements. But for the sake of his or her health, that's what they do, and so you are able to carry on a love relationship. Well, that would strike many people, I think, as kind of bad news. They don't want their partners to just want to be with them for medical reasons or for you know, all these other instrumental reasons. They want them to treat love as something that's important in itself, and they want their lovers to kind of sort of value them and their love for its own sake, not just as a means to other goals.
What I'm wondering here is whether it is possible to still favor the practice of love enhancement without falling prey to this medicalization worry that you're valuing it in an instrumental way or you're changing the conceptualization. I mean, could I not take advantage of technologies that change my emotional attachment and experience, but still value my relationship in and of itself and look at that as an intrinsic good that is not reducible to other types of good?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And this might also not be sort of an all or nothing or an on-off matter. So there's a philosopher called Hichem Nahr who wrote a reply to one of my papers where he argues that I was kind of exaggerating when I was saying that we really want to be, well, I should maybe just explain that first. So one of the things I was saying was that there's a sense that we want to be able to inspire love in those who love us. We want to be able to, we want it to be the case that because we are the way we are, who we are, that should be sort of enough for them to love us. It shouldn't be the case that you also have to bring in an external agent, so some drug to create the love. That doesn't seem to fit with what most people want. And so what Hichem Nahr was saying was that, yes, that's probably true, but what if you, it's not the case that you play no causal role in bringing about this love attachment on the part of your partner, but maybe, you know, it needs a little bit of help, you know, after maybe a few years, you know, there's still love, but it's much weaker than before. So, you know, what if we just augmented the attachment with a certain amount of love enhancements? Could still be the case that your lover values you for who you are, values the love relationship as something that's good in itself. It's just the case that there's a need for a little bit of help from some love enhancements. And I guess yes, I mean that sounds fine. I would say that the it's a kind of a sliding scale. The more you go towards the extreme where actually the person only cares about other ends and they just want to use love enhancements as a way to bring about the attachment for the sake of those other ends, that seems really kind of unattractive. And the more you are at the other extreme where, you know, you have the lovers, they value each other, they value love as an end, and they are able to sustain love without any love enhancements, that seems to be the most kind of attractive extreme of this spectrum. But, you know, there might be many points in between where you still think that the value of love has been achieved, even though, you know, there's a certain amount of love enhancements involved. And so I think we shouldn't think that, you know, it's an either or matter, that either you use them and it's bad or you don't use them and it's good.
Yeah, that's helpful. I don't want to maybe go too long on medicalization of love, but I do want to bring up an issue which connects this back to other interests that I have, which is that the medicalization objection, as you have outlined it, this way of contrasting intrinsic versus instrumental valuing of something, has a lot of parallels in other areas of applied ethical debate and debates about technology. So I'm thinking in particular here of concerns that people raise, for example, about, let's say, the commercialization of certain kinds of practices, such as kidney donation would be a famous example. The worry is that if you commercialize the practice, you might get more of it. So consequentially, it might be better. More people get kidneys. but you've changed or altered or corrupted the way in which people value or approach the practice of kidney donation. So you remove the motivation, let's say, for charitable or altruistic donation. And that could be problematic because that's the way in which we should approach the practice of kidney donation. Similarly, then I'm thinking of other kinds of technological practices relating to the self and relationships. Something I've been investigating recently is, you know, the quantified self movement and how that approaches tracking information about your individual activity, gamifying your individual activity. And this includes gamifying interpersonal relationships. There was an app released a couple of years ago, I think it's now defunct, called Canoodle, which was designed to improve relationships. It enabled people to earn kind of brownie points for romantic gestures, which could be cashed in with different coupons with their partners. So both partners had the app, but they tracked their romantic behaviors. And you know, the idea is it would improve the connection of their relationship. And I think people object to those quantification approaches in similar forms to medicalization. They don't refer to it as medicalization. They refer to it as, let's say, the commercialization or commodification of interpersonal relationships, or the neoliberalization of relationships. Do you think there are parallels here that are worth exploring or that arise in other ethical debates about technology?
Yeah, I mean, that does seem to be an instance of this general worry about making what I was calling evaluative category mistakes, namely treating something that maybe you think it's good and important in itself as if it's mostly a means to enjoying these other goods. I guess that seems to me quite similar, and it might not be a matter of making it into a medical issue, but rather making it into a case of getting these other benefits, likes or whatever it might be on the app. Or,
yeah, we're changing the mode of valuing a practice through technology. Right.
Yeah, and I should say, though, that I don't think that necessarily that has to be something that is regrettable or bad. I mean, maybe sometimes this maybe is actually what we should be doing. And so I don't think that in general this should be seen as something that is necessarily bad. I think it maybe in general should be seen as something that's worth reflecting on and thinking about very carefully. Are we improving the way that we're valuing something by using a new kind of technology to think about that practice in a new way and maybe valuing it in a new way? Or is that something that is making our lives more, maybe poorer in the sense of having less of a rich understanding of those values and just focusing on some aspects of the value and not all of them that we maybe before were emphasizing? So I think it's generally not something that we should think is necessarily bad, but it's something that's always worth reflecting on and asking, does this really capture what we think is the most important about the practices?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because what you're saying here is that we need to be cognizant of the effects on values that these technologies have and maybe explore worries that they have a less thick and rich understanding of value, that they prioritize a thinner and a narrower conception of value. Anyway, I want to move on to another topic, which is to do with the self. So the self is a central idea in modern political and ethical thought. The self is the basic holder of rights and bearer of duties. Ethical decision-making tries to respect the self's autonomy, the self's interests and values. But there are deep questions about what a self is and how the self can be affected by technology. And I'm thinking in particular here of technologies that involve some kind of merging between mind and brain with machines. And now this isn't a purely science fictional worry, because there are actual technologies in existence, such as deep brain stimulation devices, which are used for a treatment of a variety of primarily neurological or psychiatric illnesses. And you've written a paper that explores the relationship between deep brain stimulation and the self, and concerns about the use of this technology and its impact on the self. So let's just briefly talk about what deep brain stimulation is and what its uses are.
Yeah, as you were saying, it might sound like science fiction, but it's a technology that's widely used. You actually insert two electrodes into people's into specific targeted brain areas, which are connected by wires to a pulse generator that sends electrical pulses into your brain, into those areas that maybe are underactive and that needs to be stimulated. hence the expression deep brain stimulation. And now, why would you want to do that? Well, for example, in Parkinson's disease, there are certain kind of feedback loops in the brain that are not functioning properly. And so in order to make people be able to move in a fluent and controlled sort of way, you actually have to stimulate certain brain areas. And that's one of the main uses of deep brain stimulation, the treatment of Parkinson's. But that's not the only use that's been put to. There are also various experimental uses, such as attempts to treat very severe forms of depression. What we may get back to later is attempts to treat anorexia. It's also all sorts of potential areas of application, but I guess Parkinson's is the one that's been studied the most, and it's been quite successful. It's actually amazing if you see these before and after videos of people who are Parkinson's patients, and then they turn on the DBS, the deep brain stimulation, and then suddenly they can walk in a fluent kind of way, and it looks as if they don't have any Parkinson's at all. So it can be quite amazing what effects it has.
And I think I'll probably try and include a link maybe to a video showing this, just to see the stark impact that this can have on people's lives. Now, these devices are already in use in quite a large number of patients, and there have been some reported effects on personal identity. So maybe you could talk to those. There are some examples actually in the paper you sent me of Dutch patients and the stark impact that it had on their personal values.
Yeah, so maybe we can start with just it's a very positive case, which I saw on a Dutch TV show recently. So I didn't mention so far, but obsessive compulsive disorder is one of the things that is being treated with DBS devices. And there was a woman on this show who, you know, when they turn on the device, she started crying from happiness because suddenly she felt a new sense of control over her obsessions and compulsions, and she was incredibly happy to finally not constantly obsessing over having to wash her hands or whatever it might have been. So this can have a very positive effect on how you feel mentally as a person, but it can also have a very unusual and unexpected sort of effects. And some of them can be almost comical, and some of them can be quite dramatic and also quite horrible. Now, so two examples. The one that goes more to the comical side is there was a Dutch, also an OCD patient, who in the article about him is called Mr. B. And so Mr. B, while being stimulated with a DBS device, suddenly he heard Johnny Cash on the radio. And so he had previously not been a big music fan, and certainly not a Johnny Cash fan. But from that moment on, he became very, very, very interested in listening to Johnny Cash all the time. And so He would associate different Johnny Cash songs with different moods or different activities, and he would walk around in his apartment listening to Johnny Cash and feel as if he was the hero of a film. But interestingly, and this is something that we haven't mentioned yet, you can turn on and off DBS devices. And so sometimes it happens that the battery runs out, you have to replace the battery, or you can actually turn it off yourself, or maybe your physician has to turn it off. But anyway, when his device was turned off, suddenly his interest in Johnny Cash and also his newfound confidence, they both went away. On turning back on the DBS device, the interest came back, and also, well, the interest in Johnny Cash came back, and also his newfound confidence. And so that was a case where someone had a very unexpected effect as a result of DBS, namely becoming a huge Johnny Cash fan. Now, that's a slightly comical example, but it can also be the opposite of comical. There was one, I think it was a Parkinson's patient, also a Dutch case, where with the device on, the patient became manic to a degree where he had to be institutionalized. He couldn't, you know, be out in society because he was too manic in his psychology. And actually, in that particular case, while the device was turned off and he had this very severe motor impairment, the patient consulted with the doctors, and it was quite clear that there was a pretty stark choice. Either we turn on the device, keep it on, and then you would suffer mania, but your motor impairment would be perfectly cured, or we leave it off and you would have the strong motor impairments but no mania. The patient opted for having it turned on, and the team of physicians assented, and the patient ended up being institutionalized because of the very severe mania that resulted. So those are some different kinds of effects that this brain stimulation can have on your psychology that are very unintended. And of course, the idea was not to create a Johnny Cash fan. The idea was not to create a manic patient. The idea was to cure obsessive compulsions in the one case and to cure motor impairments in the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd that it had such a specific effect on a love for Johnny Cash music. I mean, yeah. Obviously, as you say, that's a slightly comical example because presumably the interest in Johnny Cash is not a major debilitation in life, I hope. Whereas being manic and to the point of requiring psychological institutionalization is a severe impact on your individual liberty. And yet it's interesting that this patient chose that over the severe physical impairment associated with Parkinson's disease. Now, examples like this obviously raise issues of personal identity, and this is where philosophers and ethicists become largely interested in the debate, because the question is, does this have a disruptive impact on our narrative identity, our identity over time, and is this something that needs to be guarded against or factored into decision-making in relation to the use of DBS devices? Now, you've suggested there's actually maybe a different concern that we should have, or a different focus that we should have. There's a contrast to be drawn here between narrative identity, identity over time, versus authentic identity or true selfhood. So could you outline that distinction between those two philosophical concepts of the self, and then explore how that affects the debate about the use of DBS?
Yes, and so let me just mention maybe one more psychological effect that DBS can sometimes have. It can sometimes make patients quite impulsive who were previously not impulsive. What sometimes happens then is that the patient, him or herself, is quite happy with how things are going, and they maybe feel more energized, and they don't see any major change in themselves. They just think that they have more energy and are more interested in things. But it happens sometimes that their families feel that the patient has become a new person. There was one a case that's interesting where the daughter of an English professor said, you know, he's there, but he doesn't feel like my father anymore. It's not him anymore. Whereas the father said, well, I just feel more energized. And so sometimes it's the families or the near and dear who feel that the personality or the person has been replaced by a different person or personality. Sometimes it's a patient, him or herself, who feel that I'm not myself anymore. I now feel like a robot. I want to go back to being me. And so that is kind of concern about somehow being replaced by another person, or having a loved one being replaced with another person, or having a very stark change or shift in the life story that you're creating for yourself. And that's sometimes what people mean when they talk about the narrative identity, that you're the author of a certain narrative. And if there's a very stark break where you kind of go off in a different direction in your psychological life, then you might feel that you've been replaced with a different person. Now, I think that that is obviously a very interesting discussion to be had, but it's a very dramatic kind of worry. The idea of being replaced by another person or having one's life story being cut off, in many cases, that's not quite going to be a realistic thing to worry about. I mean, there might be a change in personality, but you wouldn't probably say that, you know, there's a new person here. It's the same person, but with some altered psychology. And yet people often worry about the effects on the self. And so it seems that it can't just be a matter of, am I the same person as I was in the past? And one thing that people sometimes say is that they say things as I feel like I'm not truly being me, or maybe their relatives are saying like he or she is not being her true self. And so what exactly is that supposed to mean? Well, there, if you look in the history of philosophy, if you look in literature, if you look at just everyday things that people say, there's this idea of the true or the real or the authentic self. And let me just give you an example that may seem to have very little to do with this. Caitlyn Jenner, formerly Bruce Jenner, was interviewed on the Ellen DeGeneres show, having undergone gender reassignment surgery. And so Caitlyn Jenner said that, well, there's nothing better than being able to look yourself in the mirror and see your authentic self. And so the idea seemed to be that by transforming her body in this case, Caitlyn Jenner felt that she could finally be her true self. Sometimes this takes a more psychological form and not focusing so much on the body. There was an article on the Huffington Post's website that said 7 ways in which mindfulness meditation can bring out your true self. And that seems to be an idea about if you change certain patterns in the way you think and the way that you function psychologically, then maybe you could actually bring out a truer, a more authentic version of yourself. Now, those, of course, are two fairly radical examples where it seems that you have to change very much to bring out the true self. But let's relate this back to DBS. So suppose that you have, like that woman on the Dutch TV show that I mentioned, that you've suffered for a long time from obsessive compulsive disorder. And that finally, after many years, you know, you hit upon the DBS treatment and it works. You no longer have obsessions and compulsions. You can control yourself and you can, you know, do the things that you want to do and not have to, you know, wash your hands all the time or whatever it might be. It might be felt that finally you can be you. You can be your true and authentic self. So that seems to be a case where actually there's a change in your personality. And so your narrative identity is actually changed. Instead of always having obsessive thoughts, always compulsively wanting to do certain things, now you have much more self-control. You can focus on other things. And so in a sense, it would be more in keeping with your past narrative that you should continue having obsessions and compulsions. But you may feel much like the woman on the TV show that finally you can be the real you, so to speak. And that seems to indicate that there's some other idea of the self that doesn't have to do with continuity over time, that doesn't have to do with continuing the same life story that you have been enacting up until this point. Of course, the question is then what exactly is meant by this idea of the true self, but there does seem to be a different idea there. And what I wanted to argue in that paper was that actually we shouldn't just focus on the question of whether personal identity is being threatened by DBS, which has been the focus of many interesting papers. We should also ask, well, might DBS have a positive effect or maybe a negative effect on this idea of the true self?
So I think this is intuitive for most people in the sense that the concern for narrative identity, as you point out, is about consistency of the story over time, so, and the coherency of the personal story over time. Whereas actually, there are many things that most of us do in our daily lives that are consistent but are deeply regrettable and not consistent with how we like to conceive of ourselves or the personal values that we bring to bear on our actions. So I'm a frequent procrastinator, as I'm sure a lot of people are, and this isn't consistent with the person that I want to be or that I think of myself as being. And if I could do something to reduce the amount of procrastination in my daily life, I would gladly do so, and then I would feel like I'm being a more authentic version of myself. So, I mean, that's the distinction that you're drawing, and that we should have some concern for this true or authentic self, too. So let me just put this question to you. And see whether you agree with it. So the true or authentic self is really a question of a matter of values and individual and maybe social values, whereas the narrative self is really all about identity and continuity through time. Is that a fair way of drawing the distinction?
Yeah, and I think we can bring this out even more strongly if we think about cases where people are doing things that they regret or maybe are acting in insensitive and bad ways towards other people. Often afterwards, they would say things such as, "I was not being myself. Maybe I take responsibility for what I did, but that's not me. That's not who I am. I was not being myself." Or maybe if you have a loved one who has committed some crime, chances are that the relatives would say, "Well, that on that occasion he was beside himself. He was not being himself. That was not the true little Johnny or whoever it might be." So that's another occasion where people use this idea of the true self. And that helps to bring out, I think, very clearly that it is a matter of values. And so often we see the best part of ourselves or other people's as the thing that sort of is representing the true self. And also, as you were saying in your example with procrastination, what we aspire to be is often the thing that we associate with our true selves rather than those parts of ourselves or the way we function that we are maybe less happy with. We don't identify with them. And so the true self seems to partly be a matter of, you know, what qualities that I actually have are the best parts of me. And second, what are some qualities that maybe I don't have, but that I very much aspire to and that I feel that I would become more like my true self if I were able to achieve those other qualities. I think that's should bring out this idea that it's really a matter of values, and it's just not a value neutral idea, this idea of the true self.
And I think this is important because a standard objection that I would usually mount against the concept of a true or authentic self is that it's not an ontological reality. It's not, to me anyway, it's not so much that you are a true self. So when I hear, you know, young adults or teenagers talking about going on journeys to discover themselves, I have my doubts about that as a way of framing it, because I don't think there is a true self there to be discovered necessarily. In fact, that might end up being more like the narrative self or narrative identity. But there is a set of values that you aspire to or that you hold to be important in your life that may constitute this the true self in that value-laden sense, and that is what this debate is about. So presumably, if you draw this into the conversation about deep brain stimulation, the argument then is going to be that there are ways in which deep brain stimulation can actually help or enable people to become their true or authentic selves, such as the woman with OCD that you spoke about earlier on, and that this is something that it's important to factor into the conversation about the use of DBS. Also, presumably, it could have a negative impact on the true self.
Indeed. It could be that one and the same effect on a person might, from different points of view, be seen as either helping to bring out the true self, or from maybe a different evaluative point of view, being bad for the true self. And so I go back to that case where someone becomes more impulsive and maybe they themselves feel that, well, this is, I like this. This feels good. I have more energy. I'm inspired to do all sorts of things. Now I'm really being what I want to be. Whereas maybe their family members, it could be their spouse or maybe, you know, children or whatever it might be, might feel that, well, I don't like this new impulsive version of my husband or my wife or my friend, son or daughter, whatever it might be. That's not the best part of them. That's not what I think that I want them to be. So I feel that they're not quite themselves anymore. Whereas again, the person, him or herself, might feel like, well, I like this. I endorse this. This is who or what I want to be. So you can have the same effect being evaluated differently by different people, resulting in different judgments about whether the person's being there true self or not.
And this is where it becomes tricky then in conversations about the use of deep brain stimulation.
Indeed.
The example within your paper has to do with anorexia nervosa patients. Mm-hmm. And they have a set of values associated with their body image and being thin, and that is anathema to the majority of society, we find disturbing or unusual. And also maybe their values are not consistent and coherent over time. So how can we actually approach patients like this?
Yeah.
Patients that have unstable values and values that are not consistent with our own.
Yeah, so the thing with patients with anorexia nervosa is that when they are in the grips of the disease, they may have what appears to be a very strange set of values. For example, preferring dying to being putting on weight, or maybe thinking that it's virtuous and good to suffer in order to become thinner, that it's a good thing to be much thinner than everyone else, and so on. This may seem like a strange set of values, but it also typically happens, the people who study anorexia report that people who have this kind of ideas, they tend to be somewhat unstable. And so maybe some of the time when they talk with their family members or when they see their, you know, doctors, whatever it might be, they kind of agree that, well, maybe this is a problem and these are really not the kind of values I should be having, and I should really accept some treatment and try to change my life. But then fall back into the anorexia nervosa way of thinking and starting to have these values again. And so if you have that kind of unstable mindset, so that in some mindsets you have those unusual values that are tied up with the anorexia, whereas in other mindsets, you have, let's say, more normal or more conventional values where you think that it's a disease and that you want treatment. If you go back to this whole idea of the narrative identity that you have or the continuity over time, there may not be a clear answer as to what would be more in line with who you have been during the latest, maybe it could be 10 years or whatever. And so you may need to go to the question of, you know, what set of values are better values, the more conform to what people can acceptably disagree about. I mean, there are many values where we feel that we don't agree with them, but we can see how a sensible person might value those things. And the thing about the values that are associated with people with anorexia nervosa is that most other people would think that they're just too unusual, too strange to be within the realm of values about which we can sensibly disagree or agree. From a certain point of view, you might think that those cannot be the values of the authentic self of that person, that patient. It is in the mindset when they are much more open to treatment, when they think that there's something wrong with their anorexic values. That's the mindset where they're being much more their true self. But that, this seems to be another case where you can't just look at what's in keeping with their narrative identity, because the narrative identities is shifting back and forth between different mindsets, and over time it's maybe unclear what would be more in keeping with the past narrative. And so you may need to go, when you're thinking about what to do with these patients, there could be a family member, you know, what should I treat as more representative of his or her true self and her true wishes? You may have to consult your value judgments and not just think in terms of, you know, medical categories. That might not be enough for you to have an idea of which mindset you think represents that person's true self.
I think that's an important observation, because it goes to the core of conversations about the use of technology and how technology enables individual choice. Do we allow people to use technologies for self-modification or body modification? Well, maybe the test here is whether the values that they express or constitute in the use of the technology falls within the range of values that people can reasonably disagree about. And if they fall outside that range, then we have a different attitude or a different set of considerations about them. Okay, so switching away from focusing on the self, I want to go into a different topic, which has to do with algorithmic decision-making systems and the ethical choices that go into their design. And this is a topic that is central, again, to the project that I'm running, which has to do with algocracy and the rise of algorithmic decision-making in society. And I believe, and I think other people agree with this, not that I'm particularly unique or original in this thought, that this is an issue that we need to confront more and more. And it's important that we approach it in the right way. And it's definitely an issue that is emerging in the conversation about self-driving cars and how they are designed. So perhaps, first of all, I could ask you, why is it important to consider ethical decision-making algorithms in the design of self-driving cars?
So, well, first of all, one of the main engineering goals for self-driving cars is to create much safer traffic. Almost 90% of all accidents, fatalities in traffic depend on human error. And so one of the ideas is that, well, maybe if we can create cars with multiple sensors that are taking in information from other cars about the location of other vehicles on the road, and that can then coordinate their, the way that they move around on the roads, we can create much safer traffic. And so that's certainly one of the main engineering goals. Now, however, any car was going to be moving at a fairly high speed. And if you have multiple different objects moving around at high speeds, many of them are self-driving cars, but you might still have lots of conventional cars on the road. You may have animals that suddenly run out on the road. You may have children or people who suddenly appear. Here in the Netherlands, you might have someone biking that suddenly there's a bicyclist in the road. Pretty unavoidable that there are going to be accidents. It may be that there are many fewer accidents than in a scenario where we still have conventional traffic, but still there are going to be accidents. And then, of course, we have to think about, well, how exactly is the self-driving car going to react in an accident scenario? And it may seem like a good idea to always hand over control to the driver or the passenger, let's say, and make the passenger become the driver. The problem, however, is that human reaction times are quite slow. And another problem is that if you're in a self-driving car and you're not actually driving, chances are that you may be, you know, engaged in a conversation, you may be using your smartphone. And I saw a newspaper article about a Canadian expert who was worrying that you may actually be having sex in your self-driving car. So you may be doing all sorts of things except for focusing your attention on the road. And so if an accident scenario comes up, an animal suddenly appears on the road, there may be no time for you to take over control. And so the car needs to be pre-programmed for how to react in that scenario. So suppose that maybe you and there are you and four other passengers in the car. So there are a total of a number of five passengers in the self-driving car. And suddenly there's something wrong with a bus coming from the other direction, and the bus veers into your lane. And so the self-driving car quickly calculates that it's possible to avoid being hit by the bus in two ways. Either it goes off to the left, but then it hits a brick wall, and then most likely many people in the car will be injured. Or the self-driving car goes up on the sidewalk on the right-hand side. The problem being that there's a pedestrian that's walking. And so, you know, what should the car do? Should it sacrifice the five passengers? Should it collide with the bus? Or should it maybe save the five passengers and maybe save the people on the bus by hitting the person who's walking on the sidewalk? It's not obvious what the right answer is. Maybe some people might say, well, we should just save the greatest number of lives here. But others might say, well, it's unfair if people who are not driving or, you know, going in the self-driving cars or who are walking on the sidewalk, if they should be sort of sacrificed for the sake of people who want to use this new technology. So there's a huge ethical issue here, and that we have to discuss. And self-driving cars have to be prepared for these eventualities, even if they are overall safer than conventional cars.
I think, yeah, you've outlined a very clear argument for why this needs to be considered, needs to be factored into their design.
Mm-hmm.
If for no other reason than, well, the convenience of these cars is such that the idea is that you're not always in this default mode where you can take over control. And in fact, some of them are likely to be designed to prevent maybe manual override in certain contexts. But also, just in order for them to be safer at driving, they need to be programmed to deal with scenarios of this sort. Now, the example that you drew out there at the end has obviously a superficial similarity to very famous moral dilemmas and moral problems in philosophy, such as the infamous trolley dilemmas, trolley problems, which always involve these kinds of stark choices between allowing a trolley car and a train track to continue on its current course and kill five people who are diverted onto a sidetrack and just kill one person, or multiple other variations on this dilemma. And these are all supposed to probe how we think intuitively about the ethics of killing, of letting die. And they have started to emerge in the conversation about self-driving cars. If you've read any of the opinion pieces that have been written about people in this area, they always use those examples as a starting point. Now, you think that that's problematic because it's important that we start this conversation from the right place, and that framing the choices that face self-driving cars in terms of the trolley problem is not the best starting point. So why do you think that?
Well, as you said, I chose this particular example with the five people in the self-driving car and the one person on the sidewalk for the reason that, you know, in the trolley examples, usually you have a choice between sacrificing one in order to save the five or allowing the five to die in order to not have to sacrifice the one. And so in that sense, there's a very clear similarity with many scenarios that we can come up with involving self-driving cars. And I do agree with the general idea of turning to, you know, past philosophical literature on other cases that look similar and seeing maybe what can we learn from them when we approach the topic of self-driving cars and accident algorithms. However, I think there are at least three important areas of disanalogy that we have to keep in mind so that we don't get too carried away when we start thinking about the similarities between the trolley problem and the self-driving car issue. The first of these three is that I think the decision-making scenario is really quite different. So just to remind everyone of the trolley cases, so in maybe the standard cases where you're standing next to the train tracks, you see a train approaching, it's heading towards five. If you pull a switch, the train goes off on a different track and hits one. And so a lot of people think that you should do it. You should sacrifice the one, you know, by pulling the switch, saving the five. Now, is that similar to the case that we have with self-driving cars? Well, first of all, the person that's standing next to the train track making that decision is right there and doesn't have a lot of time to take a lot of different considerations into account. He sees that the trolley is approaching. He can pull the switch. By pulling the switch, he saves five, but he sacrifices one. That's basically all that he knows and that he has time to find out, because it's right there. Now, in the case of self-driving cars and accident algorithms and the choice of them, things are quite different. First of all, probably it's not going to just be one person who makes the decision. It's probably going to be a larger discussion and consisting of multiple different stakeholders who are negotiating an agreed-upon solution. So it's not just one person right then and there. They're deciding this beforehand. They're thinking about different eventualities that may later arise, but that may actually never happen. Whereas in the trolley case, it's happening right then and there. You have to make a decision right now. And also thirdly, in the trolley case, since there is no time to start taking all sorts of other things into consideration, you can just have to know the very bare facts. The train approaching, if I don't do anything, five will die. If I pull the switch, I can save the five, but one person will have to die. Only considerations that you take into account in that version of the trolley problem. Now, it would be very strange in the case of self-driving cars and how to program them if we said, okay, you're only going to take this into account. There might be scenarios where there are five lives against one, and that the self-driving car has to perform a certain turn or whatever it might be in order to save the five and sacrifice the one. You would never want people to only reason in that very minimalistic way. You would want them to take into account a much broader range of considerations. And then, as I also said, you wouldn't want just one person to decide this. You would want a larger discussion. And it's a decision that you're making prospectively about the different eventualities. So the whole decision-making situation seems to be quite different. That's the first major disanalogy. The second, should I just go to the second disanalogy or do one?
Let me just come back on the first one and we'll go into the second and third ones in more detail.
Yes.
So I think you've made a good point that the decision-making situation when it comes to the design of accident algorithms is disanalogous to the decision-making situation that faces the individual in the trolley problem thought experiment. But I do have some concerns about that disanalogy, because I think we as philosophers or moral philosophers and ethicists use trolley problems not so much to imagine how we would decide in that context, I think. I think we do it to probe more generally what we think the ethical rules or principles should be when it comes to scenarios like this. And that's why we explore multiple variations upon the same trolley problem. So we use thought experiments like this to develop default rules for ourselves in our ethical lives, or to understand what the default rules should be. And can we not use a similar practice when it comes to the design of accident algorithms? So focusing narrowly on one particular thought experiment or problem or dilemma would not be conducive, I think, to good design of accident algorithms. But focusing on many variations in a similar manner to which philosophers have debated trolley problem scenarios would be beneficial. I mean, is there any plausibility or strength to that kind of argument?
Yes, I agree. I completely agree. But I think what this suggests is that really the most important comparison here is not between the trolley problem scenarios and the scenarios self-driving cars might face, but rather it's much more interesting to go to those rules and principles that we formulate on the basis of trolley examples and ask about them and if they have application in the case of different scenarios that self-driving cars might face. And so the comparison we should make, I think, is not between the actual scenarios, but rather between maybe our intuitive responses to different scenarios that self-driving cars might face, and those ethical principles and rules that you formulate on the basis of the trolley experiments.
I think I agree with that approach. And there's a danger of the narrow framing and just focusing on the decision-making dilemma, and it's important to get into the deeper ethical principles and conversations. So sorry, I interrupted you as you were going through your disanalogy. So you had there are two other disanalogies between the trolley problem scenario and the design of accident algorithms that are important. And these are actually probably, in my mind, these are possibly more important ideas.
Yes, and so remember that I said that one of the differences between the two decision-making scenarios is that in the trolley problem, you're only supposed to take very few considerations into account. And one thing in particular that you're not supposed to take into account are the issues of moral and legal responsibility. Sometimes you're asked, sometimes people react, what about, am I going to go to prison if I pull the switch? Are people going to blame me later? And often you're asked, set that aside, because we're just asking, what is the best decision in this particular scenario? Let's not worry about moral and legal responsibilities just now. And that may, for the purposes that trolley problems are used, that may be a good idea. However, when we think about self-driving cars and accident algorithms, it's pretty clear that people are going to worry a lot about moral and legal responsibility. Now, suppose that there is an accident and that something bad happens. There was actually on Valentine's Day of this year, an accident where a Google car and a bus crashed. No one got hurt. There was a small amount of damage to the Google car. That was fine. But suppose that someone on the bus had died, or that maybe the passenger in the Google car had died, then obviously one of the first things that would have happened would have been that people would have wanted to take this to court and hold someone legally responsible. And of course, there would have been a huge discussion of, you know, whose fault was it? Who's morally responsible? And so this is something that I think is unavoidable when it comes to self-driving cars. And whereas in the trolley case discussion, we're asked to just set aside any issues about responsibility of legal and moral kinds. And so I think that being something that we can't do in the case of self-driving cars, here we have another very important disanalogy.
Mm-hmm. And I think as well in the debate about, let's say, robotics in general, this is a concern that has emerged.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say the debate about the use of autonomous weapons in warfare, the concern about responsibility gaps emerging through the use of these systems has become very prominent in the literature. And this is also clearly something that should be factored into the conversation about self-driving cars. Who bears responsibility if something goes wrong? How can we ensure that the design of these systems allows avenues for legal recourse or practices of social blame and punishment if we deem those to be valuable practices that need to persist in a world of self-driving vehicles? And I do think it's essential that we have that conversation and that we bear in mind those considerations. Also, presumably, programmers and people designing these systems are going to be concerned about legal liability, as you say, and those concerns need to be brought to the fore.
Indeed, and if this is something that is typically set aside in the literature about trolley problems, that means that a lot of this literature doesn't deal with some of the most important issues that arise when it comes to self-driving cars, and so we're not going to be helped, at least not in that respect, by the literature on trolley problems.
Yeah, I mean, I had to laugh at your example earlier on of let's set aside those issues, because I know myself, I use this example in many of my introductory classes in criminal law, and I always say that to people. I always say, ignore the fact that you might be convicted for murder for the time being, because we're just considering your ethical intuitions here for the time being and how you feel about killing.
Right.
But that brings us maybe to a third important issue, that another major thing that is set aside in conversations about trolley problems is probability and uncertainty. So I think that was your third major disanalogy.
It's assumed in the trolley problem scenarios that you know exactly what's going to happen. If you pull the switch, the train will be redirected and the fire will be saved. Another of the main variations of the trolley problem, you know, you're standing on a bridge and there's a very large man standing next to you and the trolley is approaching and there are five people on the tracks. You know that you yourself are too thin and too small to stop the train by setting off its automatic brakes. But if you push the large person onto the tracks, his body weight is going to be enough to set off the automatic train, the brakes of the train. Now, a lot of people feel that you shouldn't do it and so on and so forth. But it's also the case where a lot of people react in the following way. Well, do you really know that that's going to happen? Are you sure that by pushing the large person in front of the train, you're going to stop the train and save the five? And then you're often asked to say, well, just assume that you know for sure. You know, you're an engineer, you know this stuff. But of course, in real life, you would worry about, is this really what's going to happen? And especially when it comes to self-driving cars, as I said in the first disanalogy, you know, we're planning for contingencies and eventualities that may or may not arise. And we don't know what all the details about those different dimensionalities and scenarios are going to be. So we're operating in a situation where we have to work with probabilities. We don't know the exact situations and the facts. We can only estimate what's probable. And so on the one hand, then, we can maybe make some risk assessments. We think, well, it's probable that this kind of scenario would happen and that the outcomes would be have certain features, and which we can then evaluate, and then we can make risk assessments. But even so, even if there are, you know, it's possible to make certain risk assessments, we're also dealing with a lot of uncertainty. we just don't know exactly what the different scenarios are going to be like that the self-driving car is going to face. And so it's a very big difference between this case and the trolley scenarios, where there are only a few facts that are at play at all, and we know those with certainty. But that's just unrealistic for any real-life situation involving a self-driving car. And for that reason, you know, we have a third major disanalogy here.
And that's an important one. But, I mean, what you've outlined there is, I guess, factual uncertainties that we have in relation to particular decision-making contexts. Is the road slippy? How long will it take me to break? What's the probability that the pedestrian on the side will move out of the way? What's the probability that the impact of the car and the wall will result in serious injury or death to the passengers? And these are all estimates that have to be factored into the accident algorithm, the decision-making algorithm. And we have to figure out, you know, what balance of probabilities we are comfortable with when it comes to those factual uncertainties. But there's another type of uncertainty that's become quite prominent in philosophical debates about ethical decision-making, which is moral uncertainty itself.
Mm-hmm.
Uncertainty about which moral principles are the correct ones or the ones that we should be using in our decision-making. And let me just give a very simple example that has been used quite a bit, which has to do with, let's say, uncertainty as to whether killing animals is a bad thing, mm-hmm. whether animals have the same or equivalent moral status, roughly equivalent moral status as human beings, such that they shouldn't be killed and eaten purely for our pleasure and nutrition when there are viable alternatives. So that's a topic that reasonable people can disagree about, I think. But maybe there's an imbalance of risks involved here, and some moral theorists say, well, it's much worse to get the moral principle wrong. If it turns out that it is really a bad thing to eat an animal, kill mm-hmm. and eat an animal, it is a really bad thing, whereas, you know, just eating it because you like it isn't a particularly good or positive thing. So you should err on the side of greater risk or greater moral risk here by leaning in favor of vegetarianism, because you're less likely to commit a moral offense or moral wrong if you lean in favor of vegetarianism. So you've factored that moral uncertainty into your decision-making and you come down on one side or the other. In debates about accidents and killing, for example, in the trolley problem scenario, there's a lot of uncertainty there about which ethical principle is the correct one to use. Should we incorporate that kind of uncertainty into the design of accident algorithms? I'm thinking here of maybe outlandish examples where should the car, you know, randomize between deontological and consequentialist approaches to ethical decision making. Sometimes it should save the five people over one. Other times it should make sure that they aren't actively involved in killing people. They appeal to that distinction between killing and letting die. Is that something that could be included in this conversation about the design?
Well, first of all, I was thinking that maybe you would go a different way with that question, namely that when you assess risk, you know, you have to assign a factual probability and also a degree of badness if the outcome occurs. And of course, you may be very uncertain as to just how bad it is that, for example, that you save the five in the car by sacrificing the pedestrian on the sidewalk in the original example I laid out. And so that certainly is a further source of uncertainty and further complication when it comes to making the risk assessments. This just shows that it's so much more unclear in the case of self-driving cars than it is in the trolley scenario. However, of course, yes, as you're saying, people are also uncertain as to how to evaluate certain trolley scenarios, and so there's a lot of uncertainty on the evaluative side there too. But so that's a different point. But yes, should the car be randomizing between different moral ways of thinking in different situations? Well, I mean, that's an interesting contrast to a suggestion that I saw Anders Sandberg make in actually a YouTube video where he talked about self-driving cars. And he was suggesting something a little bit different, namely that maybe people should have a choice. So suppose that I am very zealous utilitarian, then perhaps I should be permitted to buy a utilitarian car, whatever that means. This is something I'm working on in a different paper, that it's not so clear to me what a utilitarian would recommend about self-driving cars and accident algorithms. But set that aside, and let's think that a utilitarian car would just try to save as many people as possible. This is how people usually understand utilitarian cars. Maybe if I'm a utilitarian, I should be allowed to buy such a car. However, if I'm a Kantian, I should maybe be permitted to buy a Kantian car. And so perhaps we should have different kinds of cars of different moral persuasions on the market, and people should be able to buy cars that whose moral algorithms fit with their own moral principles. Now, I personally think that that's a bad suggestion, because that would probably mean less coordination between different cars and more accidents. And so it would be better to find some kind of compromise for the sake of overall safety and coordination purposes. But that's certainly a different suggestion. I mean, the one that you brought up, that maybe the car should sometimes think in one way and sometimes think in another, and that maybe this should be randomized. I mean, that's interesting to bring back to this whole issue about responsibility. So suppose that the car reacts in one way in a certain scenario, and that the reason was that although it was programmed for how to react in accident scenarios, there was also this randomness factor that sometimes it reacts in one way according to one moral principle, sometimes it reacts in another. That might make it harder to, I'm just speculating, that might make it hard to hold anyone responsible for what happened, because they couldn't, maybe the engineers can say, well, I voted for the utilitarian principle. Another engineer might say, I voted for the Kantian principle and we had a compromise where we randomized. That just might create more confusion about how to hold people responsible and who's responsible.
Yeah, that's actually a good point, and that's something we'd also need to factor in. And to be clear, I threw out the suggestion of randomization purely as a provocative idea.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't actually think it's my idea. I think I probably read it somewhere. I can't remember where. And I was familiar with Andrew's suggestion as well, that you kind of pick the moral preferences of the car yourself. And I mean, who knows, maybe in the competitive model of car development and sales, that's what will happen. You know, Tesla will offer the utilitarian car, and Apple might develop the deontological car. I don't know. But I mean, these are all interesting inquiries. And again, I think they should be part of the conversation. Again, broadening the focus is the main theme of this conversation that we're having here, not focusing narrowly on the trolley dilemma type scenario.
Indeed.
So I think we'll probably leave it there. Just in terms of your own work and what you're working on now, are there any developments from these ideas that we've spoken about today that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, so one thing what I just quickly mentioned just now is that it's not so clear what these different moral theories imply about self-driving cars and how to program them. That's something I'm working on. In the case of utilitarianism, for example, you might think that maybe it would be better if they just were programmed cars to just save as many lives as possible. Of course, this might scare people away from self-driving cars, and maybe fewer people will want to use them. And in effect, that might mean that traffic remains as it is now with fewer self-driving cars, but more accidents. And so maybe what the utilitarian should recommend is that people should have cars that favor the passengers, because maybe then more people will choose self-driving cars. I don't know, but that's one issue I'm working on. What exactly do the different moral theories imply about self-driving cars and how they should be programmed? On the, you know, we talked about love enhancements at the beginning there, and we turned towards robotics towards the end with when we talked about self-driving cars. Actually, another thing I'm working on is the question of whether love could be achieved between human beings and very advanced robots. I think in principle it's possible, but you know, the robots would be pretty advanced, and maybe, you know, if we have to make that advanced robots, why not just stick with human beings? But anyway, that's one thing I'm working on also.
Oh, that sounds very interesting, and you know, part of my own research has been on robotics that are used for sexual purposes.
Indeed.
And I have an edited collection hopefully coming out later this year or early next year on that topic. It's a pity I didn't know that you were interested in this earlier. I could have been involved in that project. Okay, well, thanks for joining me for this conversation. I will include links to your work on the blog post that accompanies this podcast. So, yeah, thanks for joining me again, Sven.
Yeah, thank you very much.